This is VOA News coming to you by remote. I'm Gene Randall. There has been an overnight coronavirus scare in South Korea. Dozens of cases stemming from a Seoul entertainment district and 2,100 nightclubs and other leisure establishments have been ordered to shut down. South Korea is looking to contain the surge as effectively as it has done with others. The death toll among COVID-19 cases in the country is 256, with close to 11,000 cases. Social distancing in South Korea was eased when the number of new cases was less than 10 for five consecutive days. That ended this week. There have been virus outbreaks at three animal slaughterhouses in Germany. Local officials are now charged with working to stem any new spread, part of a plan for Germany to gradually ease pandemic restrictions. It has lost 7,500 lives to the virus. Pakistan today is allowing shops, factories, construction sites, and other businesses to reopen, despite a large-scale move up in COVID-19 cases, 1,600, bringing the total to about 27,500 with 618 fatalities. Pakistani Prime Minister Imran Khan explains the government cannot support millions of families that depend on daily wages. But he warns if the public fails to observe existing social distancing guidelines, strict controls will be reimposed. Clearly, the numbers in Pakistan, Germany, and South Korea highlight the risks of loosening restrictions early. In Italy, after more than 2 months of lockdown, this is the first weekend people have been allowed out for more than just work and necessities. And in Rome, the Campo dei Fiori flower and vegetable market has attracted large crowds. In Spain, health officials plan to allow the reopening of regions where hospitals have demonstrated a readiness to handle a potential second wave of coronavirus infections. Spain is one of the world's largest COVID-19 death tolls, officially put at 26,299. More news online at voanews.com. You can also use our convenient, easy-to-use mobile app. This is VOA News. British Prime Minister Boris Johnson delivers a nationwide address tomorrow and is expected to talk about how and when the UK will be able to ease its lockdown. The country's environment minister says there will be no dramatic change overnight. Britain is second only to the United States in the number of lives lost to the pandemic, more than 31,000. Globally, the case count is approaching 4 million, with more than 275,000 deaths. The numbers come from a Johns Hopkins University running tally. Here in the U.S., dozens of states are modifying or removing pandemic restrictions. This despite rising death tolls in many areas of the country and without a grand strategy for how to move ahead. The Associated Press reports that proposed reopening guidelines from the Centers for Disease Control was put on the shelf by the White House at the highest level. The advisory was put together by President Donald Trump's coronavirus task force and is designed to help business owners, faith leaders, educators, and state and local officials carry out their reopening plans with safety as a key. The AP says only after an earlier report this week did the Trump administration order that parts of the CDC advisory be fast-tracked for approval. When it comes to restarting the American economy, there is growing pressure from the unemployment numbers. Joblessness in the United States has reached Great Depression levels. April saw 20.5 million people lose work and unemployment reached 14.7%. There is a widespread belief the actual figures may be much higher. The argument for caution in a reopening is implicit in coronavirus numbers. Close to 1.3 million COVID-19 cases in the U.S. and more than 77,000 lives lost. But there is good news from the state of New York, where over 26,000 people have been lost to the virus, including another 228 in the latest daily report. But hospital admissions, the use of ventilators, and new cases continue their declines. Among those who have tested positive for COVID-19 in the U.S., a personal White House valet to President Trump and Vice President Mike Pence's press secretary. In Brazil, now with 10,000 deaths, the northeastern city of Fortaleza is putting roadblocks in place to allow only essential services. Many provincial leaders in Brazil have chosen to defy and battle President Jair Bolsonaro, who has steadily talked down the dangers of the pandemic and pushed for getting the economy back on track. Russian President Vladimir Putin has marked Victory Day, the anniversary of the defeat of Nazi Germany in World War II. The celebration in Moscow was muted by the pandemic. The usual military parade was canceled, and Putin delivered only a short address honoring the valor and suffering of Soviet troops. And he laid flowers at the tomb of the unknown soldier outside the Kremlin wall. More news online at voanews.com. You can also use our convenient mobile app. Via remote, I'm Gene Randall, and this is VOA News.
good evening and welcome to Nightline Africa. We are coming to you from the English service of the Voice of America. Thanks for joining us. I'm Peter Clotty in Washington, D.C.
We have all the hope that we are going to vote on 2nd July, but with a new make, and that the new make is going to make sure that they clean up the mess and everything else runs smoothly thereafter.
The Malawian Main Opposition Party Alliance demands new leadership at the Electoral Commission ahead of the July presidential election.
We clearly have inconsistent messages coming from the president. On the one hand, he has denied that Tanzania is facing a pandemic and has even suggested allowing our football league to reopen. But on the other hand, he has said he's sending a plane to Madagascar to pick up their COVID-19 cure.
A Tanzanian human rights activist says the president's recent statement undermined the fight to stop the spread of the coronavirus.
We are going to initiate private prosecution, criminal prosecution against the individual police officers who masterminded or caused or supervised the torture of Honorable Zaki Francis. We are fighting impunity and we shall go the full distance that the law allows us.
Attorneys petition a Ugandan High Court over torture and abuse of parliamentarian Zach Francis. Those stories and more coming up on Nightline Africa. Opposition Malawi Congress Party, or MCP, says the decision of the Supreme Court sent a strong signal that there should be new leadership to organize the upcoming July presidential poll. In its ruling Friday, the Supreme Court upheld the Constitutional Court ruling, which annulled the outcome of last year's presidential election. Maurice Muntali, spokesperson for the main opposition MCP, tells me that his party has been vindicated again by the ruling of the Supreme Court confirming the cancellation of the outcome of last year's presidential election.
Peter, the mood in Malawi Congress Party is that of jubilation. We thank God that justice has indeed prevailed. No forces under the sun in this country will force the change that God has bestowed upon us. So justice has prevailed, democracy has won, Malawi has won, and Dr. Chakwera and Dr. Chirima have been proved right because of seeking justice. And that justice, we have found it in the Supreme Court even today.
We knew we were right when we went to the Constitutional Court to petition that the results of 21 May 2019 be nullified. And we have been proved right. So this is why we are happy, we are thankful. And I know all Malawians are happy and they are thankful that in the end, justice has prevailed.
After this judgment by the Supreme Court, what's next for your party by way of getting ready for the elections in July?
We started getting prepared as soon as the Constitutional Court had ruled on 3rd February that a fresh election be held in 150 days. So since then, we have been getting prepared and we are ready. But what has added momentum to our mission is the alliance and the partnership between Malawi Congress Party and UTM. So Dr. Lazarus Chakwera and Dr. Klaus Chirima are now a pair that Malawians were looking for. So we are ready. We're not just ready, we are winning the 2nd July elections.
What is your party's position on the same Electoral Commission going to organize the upcoming July presidential election rerun?
What is very clear now is that the Malawi Electoral Commission has been proven incompetent 3 times. First, by the Constitutional Court on 3rd February. Second, by the Parliament of Malawi. And this time around, by the Supreme Court of Appeal. It can only be expected thus far that the Malawi Electoral Commission is going to resign, step down, all by themselves. If they don't do that, we'll take any necessary means, lawful means, to have them kicked out because they don't have any moral ground to run an election of this nature. After all, Malawians have lost trust in this make.
But will there be enough time for a new team to come and to organize the July election? because some people are suggesting that there could be reforms that could help ensure transparency and credibility of the election. What do you say to that?
As regards to whether the new commission will not have time to run these elections on the date proposed, that is an issue that the new commission will have to let us know, because we cannot speak on their behalf. If there will be new reforms to the electoral process, then let those reforms be tabled, accepted, enacted, and then we move forward. But those reforms should not be undertaken by this commission, because we literally have lost trust in this commission, and we will never, never take anything that is coming from Jenny Ansah and her commissioners. If anything, Malawians would love to have a delayed election than a rigged one, because we are now in the process of asking the courts, moving them to force the Malawi Electoral Commission to declare those gadgets so that they are cleaned. Our IT specialists from all the stakeholders also must see and check what is in the gadgets. If there is any mess, those gadgets must be cleaned. So we would rather have a delayed election, if that would be the proposal from the new MEC, rather than having an election that is full of mess.
Last but not the least, Maurice, if there is a delayed election, wouldn't there be a constitutional crisis in Malawi?
We are by no means advocating for a delayed election, but we have the belief that the new commission is going to do their best to ensure that within the time frame given by the Constitutional Court and the Supreme Court, an election is going to be done. We are only saying if there is mess, and it is proven also legally that we can't run an election with all the mess that they can find, then we would rather have a delayed election. Otherwise, we have all the hope that we are going to vote on 2nd July, but with a new MEC, and that the new MEC is going to make sure that they clean up the mess and everything else runs smoothly thereafter.
Maurice Muntali is the spokesperson for the main opposition Malawi Congress Party, or MCP. He spoke with me from the capital, Lilongwe. In Uganda, attorneys for parliamentarian Zach Francis have petitioned a high court saying their client was tortured by security operatives while in detention. They say the torture has led to the lawmaker to go blind for the last 2 weeks. The police arrested parliamentarian Zach for distributing food and other essential items to his constituents. The move, Zach says, was to help his constituents to cope with the hardship due to the government-imposed restrictions to fight the spread of the coronavirus. But the police accuse him of violating the restrictions. Aaron Kiza, lead attorney for parliamentarian Zach Francis, tells me that the torture and inhumane mistreatment of his client are unacceptable.
Yes, we filed that petition to the High Court of Uganda, and that follows the torture by the military and police of Honorable Zach, a member of parliament in Uganda. It was gruesome, and he is blind now as a result of that torture.
When will your case be heard? Because some supporters of the ruling party are denying that your client is blind. They are saying this is one of his antics just to get him off the hook for being prosecuted for his actions.
You cannot be blind for 2 weeks. And they are not doctors, but the medical people, the medics have confirmed his temporary blindness. And in fact, there is a medical document from government's own medical lawyers referring him from one hospital which could not treat him to another government hospital which they thought would cure his eyes and give it better treatment. So the issue about his blindness caused as a result of military and police torture is beyond dispute. The courts will determine when to hear this matter, but we are following it up closely. And we think that in this month or the coming one, it should be resolved.
What do you say to critics of your client who are saying that he should just have followed directive issued by the government, which was done in good faith to stop the spread of the coronavirus in Uganda?
Those critics are pretentious and are out of touch. Just a myopic privileged elite. How come, if my client is in wrong, the ruling party cadres who were distributing food, none of them has been arrested? And how can that stupid suggestion be advanced to explain away the torture, the gruesome, sordid torture of our client? I think that is diversionary, it's myopic, and it's hypocritical. It basically doesn't stand as an explanation of torture, as an explanation of illegal detention for days, and as an explanation for the discriminatory response of the law enforcement agencies relative to the presidential directive that no other political leader other than those chosen at his whim and caprice should distribute food to starving people. That's not how you treat people who are feeding the hungry, who are desperate, and that service was from a political leader and it shouldn't have been criminalized.
I understand a group of people has also petitioned the UN. How significant is this, and will this help your legal recourse?
Petitioning the UN is a parallel process. They are both, in a way, mutually reinforcing, as they both tend to assert the clients and dig into our client. So we support both processes. They are different. They have different pace and different actors. But they are, I mean, none of them harms the other. We welcome it.
Well, critics have dismissed your petition, saying that the government has the constitutional mandate to protect life and property in Uganda. And upon that mandate, officers of the state went to your client's house to ensure that searches are done properly without any problem, so he could be prosecuted for violating a directive meant to protect the life and property of Ugandans. What is your response to that?
No one protects life and property by destroying the life and property of others. And so government, there's no way government would have protected the life and property of Ugandans by maiming, torturing, flogging, and gouging the eyes of Honorable Zake. So that is, again, it can't stand any test. And torture is prohibited in absolute terms, both by the Ugandan constitution and international law, right from the 1948 Universal Declaration of Human Rights up to the Universal United Nations Convention Against Torture. All international treaties prohibit torture in absolute terms, regardless of the circumstances, whether it is a war, emergency, regardless.
So what's next after this petition that you filed in court?
We are going to initiate private prosecution, criminal prosecution against the individual police officers who masterminded or caused or supervised the torture of Honorable Zake Francis. We are fighting impunity, and we shall go the full distance that the law allows us.
Aaron Kiza is the lead attorney for Ugandan parliamentarian Zack Francis. He spoke with me from the capital, Kampala. In Tanzania, a prominent human rights activist says President John Magufuli has been sending mixed signals in the fight to stop the spread of the coronavirus. Fatma Karumi, the former president of the Tanganyika Law Society, says it appears the president's recent pronouncement and his apparent lack of trust in the state's laboratory could thwart his administration's effort to halt the spread of the disease. The president had recently questioned test results of the coronavirus from the government's laboratory. Fatma Karumi tells me the president's statement about the fight against the disease have been disappointing.
I think it's important to appreciate the background to Mr. Magufuli's statement. The government has designated one laboratory in Dar es Salaam, run by the government, to test for the COVID-19 virus. So all of the 400-plus positive tests which the Prime Minister announced a few days ago came from this one lab. The President appears to have no confidence in these results and has revealed that he has sent samples taken from a papaya, a goat, a sheep, a rabbit, a jackfruit, under pseudonyms. And these pseudonyms were given human names. As evidence of his distrust, he is alleging that the government laboratory returned positive results for the papaya and goat samples. Therefore, he has asked the newly appointed Minister of Justice, Mr. Mwigulu Nchemba, to investigate the laboratory. And it should be noted that Mr. Mwigulu Nchemba, a few days ago, asked the Minister of Health to refrain from announcing positive results. So Tanzania now is moving from announcing positive results to investigating the laboratory that tests for the COVID-19. It's tragic.
Some people have been critical of President Magufuli's handling of the coronavirus or the fight against the spread in Tanzania. What are your views about the way the government has handled the issue so far?
Peter, I'm extremely disappointed. The government has failed to provide budgetary support for health services and businesses, which are going to be profoundly affected by this pandemic. There seems to be a complete misapprehension of the actual magnitude of this disease, and the lack of responsive measures from the government is, frankly speaking, frightening.
From your reaction so far, do you think the government is creating the enabling environment for the scientists or health professionals to be effective in addressing the challenges posed by the spread of the coronavirus in Tanzania?
I think it's important to understand that the doctor-to-patient ratio in Tanzania, according to the WHO, is one doctor, Peter, to every 20,000 patients. Now, in Tanzania, we have a public health service, whatever it is, struggling along with one doctor to every 20,000 patients, which is funded by the taxpayer. Our frontline service providers in the public health services have no personal protection equipment, such as gloves and PN95 masks. The Minister of Health, Umi Mwalimu, condescended to meet with them last week, more than 4 weeks after the first person tested positive in Tanzania for COVID-19. Then today, the President makes his distrust of the laboratory that tests for COVID-19 publicly known. I think frontline workers, without equipment and without the confidence of the President, cannot possibly be motivated to risk their lives for the benefit of all of us.
So how do the people of Tanzania protect themselves against the spread of the disease, looking at the current situation on the ground?
We clearly have inconsistent messages coming from the president. On the one hand, he has denied that Tanzania is facing a pandemic and has even suggested allowing our football league to reopen. But on the other hand, he has said he's sending a plane to Madagascar to pick up their COVID-19 cure. All, Peter, in the same breath in today's speech. So Tanzanians are left to their own singular resources. Fortunately, the vast majority of us love our lives. And consequently, about 70% of the Dar es Salaam population who I have seen on the roadside is wearing face masks. And there are sanitizers or soap and running water in a bucket outside shops and businesses. All in all, Peter, we're making do with or without the government.
Fatma Karume is a prominent Tanzanian human rights activist. She spoke with me from the commercial capital, Dar es Salaam. In Nigeria, the Open Bar Initiative, or OBI, a group representing lawyers, has petitioned President Muhammadu Buhari to reject a recent list recommended to him by the National Judicial Council. After consideration, the president is expected to appoint members on the list to the High Court of the Federal Capital Territory, or FTC, in the capital, Abuja. But the OBI contends that the recommended candidates do not meet the needed experience and requirement to be appointed. Supporters rejected the criticisms.
They argue that it appears the strong opposition is due to jealousy. But Professor Chidi Odinkalu, a convener of the Open Bar Initiative, or OBI, tells me that his group's investigation show that at least one member on the list did not apply for the job. He also says some of the candidates got on the list on the basis of their relationships by blood or marriage with current senior judicial figures or retired judicial officials.
Look, it's quite simple. The National Judicial Council in Nigeria is responsible for appointing judges, and they've just recommended to the President Buhari to appoint to the bench of the Federal Capital Territory in Abuja, which is the most influential of the High Court benches in the country, 33 candidates, out of whom 17 are entirely unqualified. The only reason they got on the list is because they are the children, the nephews, the nieces, or mistresses of sitting judicial figures. There's nothing wrong with being any of that. It's just there's nothing unlawful about it either. It's just that those are not requirements or qualifications for becoming judges. Those are terrible, and we don't think that's proper or appropriate.
Well, Prof, do you think the president will make a consideration of your petition before making his appointment, following critics' accusations that the president has often disregarded previous petitions or concerns by groups of people about concerns in Nigeria?
It's not up to me, really, to determine whether or not the president is going to take the concern seriously. Issues in the petition are monumental, as you probably see. What he chooses to do is ultimately his decision, but what we cannot do is not bring them to his attention, which is what we've done. Now, neither the president nor the senior judges who want to pack the bench with their children and mistresses own the Nigerian judiciary. Ultimately, that's owned by Nigerian people. And if the Nigerian people want their president to listen and do the right thing by them, he will.
Professor Chidi, some Nigerian groups are saying that it appears lawyers in Nigeria or lawyer groups in Nigeria are divided. When one group is proposing names to the president, another group is criticizing it or petitioning the president not to consider these people. How do you reconcile the two in this instance?
I'm not quite sure I understand what you mean. Why should lawyers be united? There is nothing to unite over. There is self-interest at play here. People want to plant their mistresses and children and you know what on the bench for private purposes. They may or may not be lawyers, but they are playing self-interest politics. Does that mean that we should allow them to go because they may well be lawyers or something? I'm not quite sure I get you. The fact of the matter is fairly simple. Look at the facts. There are rules for getting appointed to the judiciary, and all we're saying is that these people don't meet the rules, and the rules have been junked for them because they are the children of people who control the system. And what that means is that proper candidates have not even been allowed to get a look in. That cannot be right. It has to be resisted.
Professor Chidi, what do you think the implications are if the president goes ahead with the list presented to him?
We'll deal with that breach when we get there. The moment we have the possibility to make sure that that does not happen, and that's what we are focused on. I'm not going to become a native doctor and start imagining what will happen when the future happens. At that point, it will be present and we deal with it in the present time.
Professor Chidi Odinkalu is a convener of the Nigerian Open Bar Initiative, or OBI. He spoke with me from the capital, Abuja.
Hello, this is James Butty, managing editor and host of VOA's Daybreak Africa show. Join us Monday through Friday at 03, 04, 05 and 0600 hours UTC as we bring you the latest African news, features and sports. You can also be a part of Daybreak Africa through our mail segment by sending your comments to daybreakafrica@voanews.com. Or you can call us on 001-202-205-9942. When you hear the Voice of America identification, press the number 25 to leave us your message. That's Daybreak Africa at 03, 04, 05 and 0600 hours UTC, right here on VOA Africa.
And you are listening to Nightline Africa on the English service of The Voice of America. I'm your host, Peter Clonte, in Washington, D.C. And coming up in the second half of Nightline Africa, the Saturday music spot from our collection of music from the continent. But first, Dr. Edu Kosi Amenumve is the newly appointed president of the African Securities Exchange Association, or ASEA. The group, which was established in 1993, is the premier association of 27 securities exchange in Africa. It is headquartered in the Kenyan capital, Nairobi. Members of the group came together with the aim of developing their respective exchanges and providing a platform for networking. I reached the newly appointed president of ASEA to get his opinion on the impact COVID-19 is having on the African stock exchanges, which appear to be already fragile. The past few weeks have seen sharply decreased trading and falling market. Dr. Amenumve shares some of the measures that the association is trying to implement to help cushion the effects of the pandemic on African markets.
I would like to take this opportunity to say that my vision is to make ASEA a stronger African organization which can play a key role in terms of financing the development of our countries. For that, we need to be more, we need to have more advocacy and interaction with our political, economic authorities, and also have a commitment with our private sector in each of our countries. Capital markets, usually in many regions in the world, play a key role in terms of economic development. That can be also the case in Africa. And for that, our association is fully engaged to achieve this in our countries.
So Dr. Amenumve, how is ASEA, your organization, currently functioning in this period of this pandemic?
I can say that the association is functioning very well. Our secretariat based in Nairobi is executing our strategic plan for this year. We are continuing also to execute our major projects that are AELP, the African Exchanges Linkage Project with IFDB, and also the Data Portal Project with FSDA Africa. So I can say that we don't have any difficulties to continue to execute our program for this year amid the COVID-19 crisis.
What are some of the challenges being experienced by members of your organization, and what are some of the remedies to resolve them?
As all the exchanges around the world, our first challenge was to continue to operate our platforms by activating our business continuity plans. The second challenge was to preserve the confidence in our markets. As remedies, we allow our staff members to work remotely with the necessary equipment, and we publish some directives to invite listed companies in Africa to give to the investors all the accurate informations that are necessary to inform them on the impact of the COVID-19 on their activities.
How do you plan to make the organization robust in its prospect during this period of uncertainty?
Our association adopted a strategic plan in 2018. This plan was focused on advocacy, liquidity, capacity building and regional integration. We need now to revise this strategic plan to take into account the new challenges amid COVID and to provide to our countries new solutions to finance the recovery of our economies.
How will regional integration have a significant impact about the work of your organization?
Thank you for this question. As you may know, the regional integration process started in Africa many years ago. But during the last years, we started to work on how we can integrate capital markets on the continent. You have some initiatives in the West, in the East, and in the South. But as a continental association, we started last year to work on a linkage project with seven of our exchanges involved. And I think that this project will help to faster the development of the continent, as we need to raise funds at the continental level to finance infrastructures and many projects that involve two, three, or more countries on the continent.
Dr. Edo Kosi Amenumve is the newly appointed president of the African Securities Exchange Association, or ASEA. He spoke with me from Ivory Coast commercial capital, Abidjan. COVID-19 has come with challenges world over. But in Zimbabwe, regular citizens are making efforts to help the most vulnerable among them. For VOA, reporter Kutsavais Vanavashi spoke to some of these everyday Zimbabweans who are making a difference during COVID-19.
Samantha Morozoki is a young immigration lawyer and entrepreneur. At the beginning of the lockdown, she sought to help her vulnerable neighbors by providing them a simple meal.
I just want to help my neighbors because I'd heard their stories and these are people that I know on a personal basis. And then when I found out that they were eating, I made a plan so that they'd get something to eat. And I had 24 people come through and I thought that would be the number that I'll be dealing with as the days went by.
But she was wrong about the numbers. She says the numbers doubled the following day and have been increasing since. As of Thursday, she says they fed over 1,000 people. Morozoki says it does not take much to lend a helping hand to those in need and urges others to spare a plate of food to those less fortunate. She speaks about the vulnerability of Zimbabweans during the lockdown.
It's really sad, the fact that people cannot go to work, and yet the majority of the people that I'm serving, for example, are informal traders. There's no way people can be able to provide food for themselves if they're quarantined. They're super vulnerable right now. A word cannot express.
Morozoki's meal service is just one of many initiatives that young Zimbabweans are pushing to help get the country through this crisis. Others provide shelter, relief kitchens, clothes, and even fundraising towards equipping health facilities with equipment and medicine. Thousands of dollars have been raised towards these initiatives. Hundreds of thousands have benefited and continue to benefit. Henry Chigama is the founder and CEO of Eat Out Movement, which is a social impact organization whose goal is to end homelessness in Zimbabwe. Chigama says, so far, they've distributed over 700 food hampers to thousands of vulnerable Zimbabweans.
We have been working in a number of areas, targeting the homeless community, the vulnerable communities. We have had more than 300 homeless people in our shelters as we have partnered with government to set up homeless shelters mainly in Harare. In Bulawayo, we are supporting Jairus Jiri, which is also one of the centers housing 30 of our homeless boys.
These young Zimbabweans show that even during COVID-19, anyone can help contribute to the common good. For VOA, this is Kudzai Zwinawashe from Harare.
Right now, it's time for music from our African collection.
So tell me who they love when nobody wants to show. show. And if I have to tell you all the things I got to say, I know I started talking, you don't wanna walk away. Cause me, I gotta stay, but do you wanna stay? I wish I didn't have a new whip. Oh, I wish you, I wish you, I wish you that I didn't have a heart.
I didn't have a heart.
Then I only stone filled up inside. I didn't have a heart. I don't know why they say that love is blind. Sometimes it feel like when they cry, the breast rewind. Yeah. Cause it's the kind of feeling that you can't deny. Today. With you, with them, with you, with each and every day. See, I can understand it, why you trip me this way. Why does love have to be this way? Send me your wanna, but we can't wait for you. Your love to make me happy, to make me hate to you. Baby, boo, I pray for you. Not waiting, I could do. Cause this love is up to me too. I wish that I didn't have a heart. Then I only stone filled up inside. I didn't have a heart.
Malé,
pambe hapo nyuma tulishindiaga mabwende karanga na makande galido na sembe usinune kwa maneno ya majirani wanoko hawaishi longolongo ni maneno kama viroboto anakesha wakiomba unichape game kongoto jamani sielewi. Mapenzi matamu spending my life spending my life spending my life kwani mapenzi matamu. Let somebody go crazy. Things we
just you and I. Things we say, just you and I. Make the people say you and I don't come from earth, no. Yes, I be a sugar daddy, and she don't want nobody but me. You like it when I go crazy. You, I can never leave. Amarula, oh, have you seen my Amarula? So sweet and fine like Amarula. She comes in the morning, Amarula. Still have her in my night time. Amarula gives me hangover, Amarula. But I don't care, no. Amarula, so smooth and clean like Amarula. Don't ever touch my Amarula. She don't get drunk easily. She can dance till 5 in the morning. Make the people say you and I don't come from earth, no. Fire, fire upon my road. She can be my control. Maybe my own rule. And it is only you, yeah. Yes, I be a sugar daddy, and she don't want nobody but me. You got me going so crazy. I don't want nobody but you. Amarula, oh, have you seen my Amarula? So sweet and fine like Amarula. She comes in the morning, Amarula. Still have her in my night time. Amarula gives me hangover, Amarula. But I don't care, no. Amarula, so smooth and clean like Amarula. Don't ever touch my Amarula. Oh, have you seen my Amarula? So sweet and fine like Amarula. She comes in the morning, Amarula. Still have her in my night time. Amarula gives me hangover, Amarula. But I don't care, no. Amarula, so smooth and clean like Amarula. Don't ever touch my Amarula.
That was music from the continent. We hope you enjoyed it. Nightline Africa comes to you on Saturdays and Sundays at 16 and 18 hours UTC from the English service of the Voice of America. And from the rest of the Nightline team, managing editor Shaka Saleh, reporter Douglas Impuga, and producer Saida Hamdoun, we say thank you for joining us tonight. And remember, as the elders say, stealing a drum is easy, but finding a place to beat it is not. I'm your host, Peter Clotte, in Washington. Good evening, Africa.